Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, this is Jane Ross, host of Film Talks On Air. My special guest with me today is filmmaker Vincent Ward. Welcome, Vincent.
Hi, Jane.
How are
Great
you?
Great to be on your show. I'm good.
Good, yeah. It's wonderful to be talking to you again, because the very first time that I interviewed you on the show was back in 2021. You were living in the Ukraine at the time, working on a different film. But we were talking that time about two really significant films, Vigil and The Navigator, which won international awards, and you actually were the very first New Zealand filmmaker to compete and be selected to compete at the Cannes Film Festival. So I was just absolutely delighted that I could talk to you and screen both Vigil and The Navigator, which are just such visual masterpieces. And I am really lucky that you're going to be my very special guest in person this time. You're back in New Zealand, and you're going to be part of the Wairarapa Film Festival, which is running for four glorious days from Thursday the 23rd of May till Sunday the 26th of May. And I'm really looking forward to having you here in the Wairarapa to look at some other films that you've made. And one of them in particular, I wanted to start by talking about a local film that you made when you were a young art school student. In 1976, you began a documentary about a local character of note. Please tell me about her.
Well, the film's called Mar Olsen. It's just a short film, about 15 minutes long, and 15, 20 minutes. And it's about a woman who lived on Maroa Road, just outside Greytown. Mm-hmm. With her, I don't know how many chooks she had, but it seemed about 100. And with more roosters than chooks, it seemed, so they seemed to be a bit out of kilter. And she was such an extraordinary character, and I always remembered her from when I was a little boy. She would bicycle along Maroa Road on her bicycle with her bundles of eggs in her bike carrier. And she had flaxen white hair that seemed to burst out of her head, and it seemed to explode out of her head, and she had a missing tooth. And so I always thought she was a witch when I was a little boy, but she was always nice to me and friendly, because my dad used to do a lot of social work around the Wairarapa, and she was one of the people that, you know, he would help with just different things. If she needed her fence fixed, he'd go along and do it himself. And so, you know, I don't know if these people still exist. She was sort of born and raised on the Whanganui River, and she was a shepherd. She could handle a stock whip when she was about 14, and when she was about 18, stock whipped the local milkman because he kicked his horse, and she was really unhappy about that. She got in a lot of trouble for doing that. And then she had some children, and she ended up living on her own. I guess, I don't know, maybe her husband died. But she lived with her chooks and her cats, or a whole range of cats. She could extract an eye if the cat had conjunctivitis, and, you know, she would treat the cats medically in whatever way she could for their survival. Or she'd chop off the head of a chook with an axe. But at the same time, she did the most exquisite fine embroidery, you know. And so just this really independent, strikingly individual personality.
And you were fascinated with her.
I just thought she'd make a great subject for a film. I'd never made a documentary before, so it was my first experiment in making a documentary. But, you know, the film's strength is the person. You know, she's such a, you know, striking character.
Now, I'm really excited that we can show this film to local audiences, because I always think it's really important that when you've made a film about a local person, that you then show that film to the people in which that film was made, right? And to the best of my knowledge, this has never been shown in a cinema ever before.
I don't think it's ever been shown. I mean,
wow.
it was meant to be screened on television in New Zealand, and for one reason or another in their programming, it didn't work out. And then it just was never screened. It was never screened theatrically. And now we're lucky to see it, thanks to you, and encouraging the restoration of it. Thank you, Jane. The New Zealand Film Archive, that are doing a spectacular job as we speak.
Yeah.
It'll be doubled up in the way it should be with In Spring, One Plants Alone, which was the next documentary I made. But this time it was in the You're Aware It, although, unusually, it was my obsession with elderly women at the time. Maybe I was grandmother deficient.
Yes.
And so I kind of made, I always feel that films are a great way for making up for gaps in your life.
I agree with you. Yeah.
Relationships you never had. So, so it's a great comment. And in terms of the programming, I'm really thrilled that you've been able to put the two films together, one about this aging Pākehā woman and the other about this aging Māori woman.
How did you come to be in the Irrawaddas?
Well, I was at art school and I had some success. I'd done a film called A State of Siege and I was doing my master's, my honours year. And I kind of always had this question in my mind, with the Māori renewal and the interest in language that was happening, this is in the late 70s, 1970s, what really remained, what was alive at a grassroots level rather than at an academic level. And so I thought I'd go out and find out. And I thought the most traditional areas are most likely the Whanganui River in and around that area or in the Uruweras. So I decked out my van and my back from schools as an amateur carpenter with a little wooden bed and headed north. And I didn't know what I come to. So I went to the heart of the Uruweras and I camped by a creek there. And this big Māori guy came out and he was a friendly guy, as wide as he was tall. And he said, "Hey, boy, you don't want to drink from that creek. There's a dead cow just up upstream." And he said, "Come and have a kai with me." And so I went to his place, and it was a kind of rough buddy with two pig's heads lying on the kitchen sink. And we had a feed, and I think I can't remember if I stayed in the buddy or stayed in the van. And I explored around the area a bit. People were kind to me. And then I thought, well, I don't know really. I'm not going to get anywhere doing this. So I went and saw John Rangihau and Timothy Karatu at Waikato University. And they took pity on me and gave me some advice. And so John Rangihau, who was a tribal leader at the time, said, "Okay, be at Waiohau on such and such a date." He said nothing more than that. It was sort of like a challenge.
Right.
And figuring. And that's all he said. He said, "Be at Waiohau on such and such a date." In other words, Pākehā boy, if you think you're up for anything, you better be there. So I went there and, I'm like 19 or 20 or something, 19, I think, 20. And it was really, for me, Dā was all in Māori and I didn't speak any Māori. And then this woman asked if she could have a lift back to Whakatāne, this older woman. And I said, "Yeah, sure." So I gave her a lift. And then she said, she knew what I was looking for. I said, "Oh, well, he suggested some kuias," and she said, "Sure." And she mentioned several names and described them. And then she said, "Oh, this one, oh, no, you wouldn't be interested." And, of course, the moment she said you wouldn't be interested, I became really interested.
Yeah.
And so she took me out there. And so I met Puhi, this woman in her 80s, and we were both super embarrassed. We had nothing to say to each other. She didn't speak English or... I didn't know that she spoke any English at all. But I came out two or three more times. I brought a sort of gifts because salt water, which has a spiritual connotation for particularly for inland Maori, and fish heads gifts.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we kind of built up a friendship. And then one day on the around the fourth visit, I suddenly realized this giant of a man, 220-pound son, who had been hiding every time I'd visited, paranoid schizophrenic. Mm. And so eventually over a period of time, I started to document their life in a very matter-of-fact sort of way. And it was a here and now documentary, a kind of cinema verite film.
Mm.
So I made this short feature from it. It took me 2 years. I thought I'd film it in a few weeks, but the old lady would get tired after 4 days, 5 days. She'd kick us out, or I'd stay on, crew would go with two other people. And then she was always happy to have me there. I'd take her into town, I'd do things for her. When the sun would explode and smash the front deck with his hammer or his axe, I'd then repair it. Finally, I got to repair it with 4x4s because I thought, well, I'll try this. You're not going to break this. So he smashed a couple of windows. He was quite he would build up his anxieties over the period of a month, and then suddenly he'd explode and sometimes chase her with an axe. He never seemed to want to take me out for some reason. And I liked him, you know. I just think it's a very difficult life for both of them.
Yeah.
So I tried to document them and understand, but basically just show it how they live. And she was kind of deeply spiritual person who would karakia, pray over water, sit down and pray on her haunches and pray over all sorts of things. She'd pray in the back of my van when we would go into town. And not because of my driving, and just because it's a tradition of going from one tribal area to another, that's what you did. So that was the story. And the film did very well. I mean, it's not a huge commercial success, but it won two film festivals.
So I'm looking that you the film has won the Silver Hugo at the Chicago Film Festival. That was in 1980. That's a really big deal, and I'm going to tell my Chicago cousins that they've got to actually watch this film, and I want them to tell me how it resonates for them, because I love this film, Vincent. It is not just one of my favourite films that you have made. It's actually one of my favourite films ever. And my favourite scene is actually when you're driving into town and Puhi's taking Nikki to have his hair cut, and there's a moment in the barbershop where she unwraps an ice cream and hands it to him. It's just so beautiful, and it shows the love and connection between the two of them. But I've always thought that what is just so entirely remarkable about this is the relationship that you had with them, and the trust that you had with being able to tell the story in the intimate way that you did. And it still blows me away that you, at 19 years of age, moved in with this family. And speaking to Nancy Tate, who was someone that you came to work with very closely later, she was your cultural advisor. She's also made a very similar observation when I've been speaking with her recently, that she said, you know, we thought, who was this boy with the long hair talking to the old lady when she didn't even talk to us? And there is something so special about the relationship that you had with her, Vincent. And it's been recognised internationally because of the awards that you've won. So we've got the Silver Hugo at the Chicago Film Festival, but also the Grand Prix at Cinéma du Réel in France. So it won international acclaim. So congratulations, Vincent, for that. Because, again, this was one of the earliest films that you made. And you said, like, in the end, it ended up taking about 2.5 years to make this film.
Yeah.
That's a long and dedicated run, but not unlike the kind of time that you give to the films that you make, right?
Yeah, well, I've been on one film for 24 years, and I'm still actively trying to get it across the line.
Oh.
Because it requires the money to do that, because, you know, not in a insignificant amount of money. While I stayed with Kruhi some of the time mm-hmm. at her place, you know, I didn't want to burden her further, so I also stayed in a shack. There was no running water or electricity. And when I stayed in the shack, which was sometimes like 3 months at a time, you know, I'd make my own fire to cook food, and I got really sick. I got conjunctivitis, the flu, and ringworm, and the neighbour was this tough guy who never spoke to Pākehās at all. And in fact, when the illegal black helicopters came in to try and steal deer from the Uruweras, he'd shoot at them. And so people were amazed when he was kind to me, because he sort of would take me in and save my head. He gave me a haircut, shaved it right down, and tried to treat the ringworm with, I can't remember, petrol or something. But and kind of I won in a funny sort of way. I got respect of some of the locals because you know, I come from a farm, and my father had gone through harsh experiences, so it wasn't sort of anything particularly new to me. It was new in many ways, but not in others, you know.
It resonated so much around the world, because I'm looking at a review that from the San Francisco Chronicle, a vignette of tremendous visual power as Ward explores the circumstances of the woman's life in isolation. There's no question about Ward's talent or the empathy that spurred him on. And I think that is really eloquently saying what I'm not so eloquently trying to say, that there is just something so beautiful and moving about the intimacy of the story and what you've captured. And the old lady, Pūhi, she stayed with you in your consciousness for a very long time, did she not? And I know that you ended up having questions that you never had the answers for when you were young, but you came to want to answer those questions later on in your life. Tell me about that.
Well, 27 years later, after I'd finished the film, I still felt kind of haunted. And I don't mean haunted in a bad way. I mean sort of like haunted in the way of carrying a guardian with you. And all these questions went unanswered. And part of it was I felt guilty because you know, the year I completed the film, she never got to see it. I went down to take it to her, and it blew up a 3-pin plug because I only had a dodgy old projector, and or maybe the wiring was terrible in this hall that I tried to screen it in. And so she never saw it, and she said, "Oh, meant to be, doesn't matter." And then I wasn't there for a funeral because I was overseas, and so I always felt bad about that. And so then I'd decided to make a film about the here and now. It was like, what you see is what you get, nothing more, no narration, nothing. This is what is observed in the behaviour of these people. Who are they based on what they're doing in the present? But 27 years later, I wanted to know more. And so I gathered together, I did 60 interviews with about 50 of the elders and different people, different ages, men and women, guided by a particular elder who was considered quite a spiritual person in the area and guidance. And there's been a book written about him, in fact. And I would interview people in twos and threes generally, so that if one person gilded the lily, then somebody else pointed out. And And because I'd been there so long before, I knew the hints and the avenues and the parts of the story that hadn't been told. And so I had glimpses of it, but there were some things I didn't know, and I wanted to find them out. And this film became Reign of the Children. It's a feature film, screened in cinemas in New Zealand, it was screened in other countries. It won a film festival and one of the major film festivals in Eastern Europe. But what I found was that she had been a princess. There had been a cult run by Ruakanana, a religious belief system in the Uruweras in around 1906. And Rua had had 12 wives. And two sons, and the eldest sons married Puhi when she was 12, and she was pregnant by the time she was 14. But the curious thing is she was pregnant to, not necessarily to him, but possibly to his other son. And so basically I was going back through the gossip of 1912 and 1914 and going on to the police raid, this terrible police raid that happened, that was, should never have happened, was a travesty, in 1916, when 60 armed constabulary came into the Uruweras. And so the film, the feature film, is about Puhi's past, starting 10 years before she was born, the circumstances that led people to the religious community at Mount Maungopahatu, that led to Puhi and her marriage to Fatu, the eldest son, the Rua and his wives, and some of the stories to do with that. And people were very generous and knowledgeable, and descendants from what had happened. And then what became of Puhi after that, after the police raid, when some said that she'd been a bringer of ill luck, and certainly ill luck had descended upon her. And it tracks what became of her with the three husbands. I don't want to give away too much, because it's one of those lives that's really interesting.
Yeah.
But which next sentence you would also add hastily, may you never live an interesting life.
Oh, wow.
Because was way too interesting, that line. But for a filmmaker, of course, you know, it's one of our stories. It's one of these stories you don't ever hear. Well, and let alone not a quick television, done in a week sort of thing. Something which we took 3 years, more than 3 years, over a much longer period, making.
Why, that's the kind of dedication that I've come to know you for as a particular filmmaker, that you do put in that amount of time, even just gathering the story, making sure that you have talked to all the people that you want to talk to get to the heart of all the stories and backstories of a person. Now we're really lucky because we've got you, and you're going to be there to introduce the film and talk to the audience. But we also have one of the kaitiaki that worked really close with you, Nancy Tate. She will be travelling down from Rotorua to be with us, and I'm really looking forward to meeting her because I know that she really was really valuable to you throughout the making of the film.
Yeah, well, Nancy's kind of unusual. Well, not so unusual, but unusual in terms of media, in that in her upbringing, she's a woman, I don't know exact age, but, a Kiwia. And she jumped a generation, so she was brought up by the old ladies. And she wasn't brought up by her mother. And so she became a receptacle for the traditional knowledge, a lot of traditional knowledge that other people wouldn't have had. So I was super lucky to have her support making Reign of the Children. And I also had another non-Tūhoe cultural advisor, Tainui Stevens, who's a wonderful producer and director in his own right. So I was, well, you know, I mean, for example, one day we were filming, you know, it's weird stuff happened, you know, like, and you, then outside of the ken of normal Pākehā experiences, like, you know, one day we're filming, one evening, night, we're filming on a road and we're filming and Nancy says, oh, you can't film here anymore. And because we kept hearing these Morpork's, and she said, just can't film here. And then later on, she explained that she felt they were the ancestors demanding we not film in that area. But other things, when I did the original in Spring One Plants Alone, and I'm not a particularly superstitious or mystical person, but my sound recorder started to freak out. He was on part of the Marae recording. This is when I did the original in Spring One Plants Alone. And he just felt this beam of intense pain hit him in a wave. And he was sort of being told, get the F out of there.
Wow. Now, oh, my goodness.
And it wasn't from anyone on that Marae. It was from something else. And so strange things would happen that you, in terms of our normal, you know, our five senses, they're just such a small part of who we, they're a major part, but they're only a part of who we are and how over the, you know, however long we've existed for as human beings, there have been other senses at other times that have been more dominant or been, have had more dominance. And some of those, when you live in that community, some of those senses are become activated.
Yes. And I'm looking at how, again, this film resonated around the world at international festivals. You won a string of awards, but I do really want to draw attention to the Grand Prix at the New Era Horizons Film Festival in Poland. That's like a really big film festival in Eastern Europe, and I know that because I used to live in the Czech Republic, and I'm seeing that you got awards from film festivals in the Czech Republic too, and that fills me with an immense pride. But yeah, Canada, Australia, Thailand, Hawaii, Chicago, that's amazing. Seoul International Family Film Festival as well. You just got so many awards internationally. Why do you
I don't know, some of them were just festivals we were at.
Festivals and nominations? I can see nominated for Best Film and Best Director as well, and that's also Asia Pacific and for New Zealand and Australia, nomination for Best Director for the Australian Directors Guild. Why do you think this story resonated internationally with so many audiences?
I think it comes down to the people in the story and the generosity of the people, of the Tūhoe, Iwi and elders and other people that, you know, Judith Binney, for example, that famous New Zealand historian, but she knew Pui. So all these people that helped me on this journey, with this sort of story, you have to say, look, I'm a zero. What counts is this human being, and how can I kind of get to the nub of who they are and their experiences within the 90 minutes of screen time? And so I think why it resonates with some audiences, with some communities especially, is that it's grassroots, it's authentic, and you feel empathy for this person because she communicates. You know, you reach in to find out who the hell she is and bring her up to the screen to talk with us in the cinema, so to speak, through the experiences of her life. And her life, you know, we all have shit happen in our lives, things that are just hard to deal with, and we have to get up. And that story talks about someone who's a survivor who had terrible things happen, but always had the courage to get up.
Yes.
And continue.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at what Graham Tuckett said in his Dominion Post review, and Graham's always been part of the Wairarapa Film Festival too. That's just a by the way. But reading here that this is, he says, this is the most poetic and resonant film that this wonderful writer-director has produced, Reign of the Children, is a maddening, haunting, moving and extraordinarily watchable film. Oh, those are really lovely words from Graham. So, which reminds me, Graham, please come to the Wairarapa Film Festival. In the very first year when I screened Vigil and The Navigator, Vincent, I also screened his documentary about Barry Barclay, because Barry was born here in Masterton and went to what was St. Joseph's, which is now Chanel College. So I'm always really keen to keep the festival family happening, and it's really, really always lovely to have these kind of connections with the wider film community that come and support filmmakers such as yourself. So I'm doing that, and I'm loving the fact that I'm getting phone calls from you telling me all the people that are interested and are lined up and are coming to support you and support me. And it's actually a really deeply gratifying experience to be able to share your stories and share the stories that you tell with a new audience in 2024. Now, I want to step back in time again, back to when you were still a young and long-haired art student and you'd been studying at the Elam School of Fine Arts down in Christchurch.
Elam,
yes. And the film that I want to highlight will be screening at Aratoi, Wairarapa Museum of Art and History, and that is A State of Siege. And I really wanted to screen this film this year in particular, Vincent, because of the fact that there's so many celebrations happening with the 100th birthday of Janet Frame. And this, of course, is an adaptation of the Janet Frame novel, A State of Siege. And it was released in 1978. Did it get a cinema screening in 1978?
Yeah, it was screened all around New Zealand in the main major centres. And within Springline Plants alone, it was screened in five cities in a commercial release in America and got great, fabulous reviews, LA yeah. Times, San Francisco Chronicle and so on, and a couple of international film festivals, including Miami Film Festival. So it's relevant this year, as you say, because it's Janet Frame's 100th anniversary. Janet liked the film a lot. She sent us a really supportive and fantastic comment on it, and she was so generous, and we didn't pay for the rights for it. We asked her permission. She gave us permission. She knew we were, Tim White and myself, is a well-known New Zealand producer. She knew that we were, didn't have, two sticks that we could rub together, and so she let us film it, and we filmed it like Mar Olson. We filmed part of it, in this case, in the Wairarapa, and we you know, my dad helped, and Doug Fairbrother from the Great Elm, one of the Great Elm garages, helped. He lent us a 1936 Fargo bus, and we took a whole bunch of school kids all the way out to Ngawi and the Pinnacle. We filmed out at the Pinnacle. We took the kids out to Ngawi as if we were in the north of Auckland, pretending we were in the north of Auckland with the bus. And so, the community around Great Elm helped. And then the story... Mm-hmm. Which is, I guess, the most important thing. Story is sort of, you probably tell it better than I after all this time, but sort of about one dark night, one solitary night for a retiree, 56-year-old Malfred Signal, who's gone up north from Dunedin to live her dream of being an artist, painter. And that one long dark night, things unspiral, and it becomes quite in its own way, quite a frightening story for her, as she feels under jeopardy from a possible intruder, alone in a house with a phone that she finds 3/4 of the way through her phone call isn't connected. And I'll leave you with that put on it.
I know, I've got...
And great
shivers
actress,
down my spine.
Anne, oh my God. Yeah. What an incredible performance. She was teaching drama at Wellington Drama School at the time. And I, you know, we did auditions here, there, and everywhere for someone to play the part. And she was such a saint to work with. You know, here were these young kids, me and Tim, and Jeff Murphy helped also. You know, he operated a crane. Alan Bollinger was the cameraman. You know, Jeff worked for free, Al worked for peanuts, you know, because we didn't have anything. We weren't getting paid anything. And I put what money I'd scratched together working in shearing gangs and at the local cheese factory to try to make the film. We got a tiny amount of money from the Film Commission, like nothing. You know, you put yourself out. Filmmaking is about risk. And so you put yourself out on a limb. And if you're unlucky, you know, someone will let the branch fall down. And if you're lucky, people will help you. And in this case, people really did help me. So, it's like a good experience.
That's a really good, incentive or a way of inspiring young and emerging filmmakers as well, because I've talked to Jeff Murphy. I met him back when I was living in Dunedin, and I had a relationship with Rialto Cinemas, and every time a New Zealand filmmaker was coming to Dunedin, I was called upon to look after them, host them, and introduce them. And when I met Jeff, he had just released his autobiography and was touring up and down New Zealand. And alongside that, with HarperCollins, they were screening the original Goodbye Pork Pie. And it was just such an absolute pleasure to sit next to Jeff Murphy while he watched his film. And, you know, I always say, do you want to sit and watch this film with me? And he really did, because he said to this day he still gets a kick out of seeing the response from the audience and how they respond to different things. And it was just such a privilege to share that with him. But he has, and Alan Bollinger has said this as well, in the absence of a film school, a proper film school back in the 70s when, you're learning your trade and your tricks, you fall into it. You learn on the side of the road, is what Jeff Murphy used to say. That's how I learned filmmaking. I learned it on the side of the road.
I think all of that at that time, you know, yeah. I was officially at art school, but for three of those years, I used to come down, used to go up to Christchurch. I was living in Wellington and then later in Auckland. And I didn't have a place to stay in Christchurch anymore. So I'd sneak into the film school, art school, and I'd sleep in a cupboard on a mattress. And the cupboard door would be open and the mattress would be spread out. And I'd see the security guard's torch shining through the window, and I kind of just dodge out of the way. And then I'd sit like that for a couple of weeks, and then I'd go back down to Wellington. You know, I'd miss all the lectures, which was to do with the fact that I didn't particularly get on with my lecturer ever since I put my foot through his ceiling while he was having lunch, and all this film spiraled to 15 millimeter film that had been sitting in between the floor that spiraling out down onto his table. He was a nice guy and he tried to make it work for everybody, but you kind of, in the end, you learn by doing.
You do.
You learn by being out of your comfort zone. So that's what happened. And Jeff was a character.
Yes.
Jeff always looked at me down his nose. Jeff's fast and loose and great storyteller and great sense of humour, and he'd say, I can't say this all because it's a bit profane, but he'd say, Jesus, you F spiders! which, in other words, you take too much time on the detail, but my films are about detail. They're different from Jeff's, and so those kind of details pay off for me. So it's just a different way of making movies, you know?
Yes, yeah, you had your art school sensibilities with you.
I just like detail, and I find that often the grain of sand tells you about the whole beach.
Oh, I like that. Oh, I'm going to write that down and share it with the world later. Vincent, I'm really happy that we're going to be screening A State of Siege in an art gallery. I think that's a really nice place for it. And I'm looking at something that was written again by the San Francisco Chronicle in response to this. This is 1978. Ward creates more horror in this low-budget movie with this play of light and shadow than Stanley Kubrick was able to create in the whole of The Shining. Wow. What do you think about that? That's really quite the.
I must have paid her a lot of money. I just can't remember it.
Okay. So you slipped her something. That's incredible. I would just be so over the moon if somebody had anything close to that to say about anything I'd done.
I'll say it, Jack. You deserve it. You're such. May I say, you are a genius organizer, and you say nice things about me, which I can't pay you enough.
I am so humbled that whenever I ask you to help and be present and do interviews and turn up in cinemas, that you always say yes. So I want to say, Vincent, thank you for being my yes man. And I'm really looking forward to you being here in the Wairarapa and sharing these stories with a whole new audience. And every time I speak to someone and I say, oh, and Vincent's going to be here, everyone gets beyond excited, like quite jittery about the whole thing. So there is excitement building.
Yeah, you haven't spoken to all those critics, right?
What's that?
Well, maybe they're all creditors. I'm just kidding.
It's gonna be an amazing 4 days, right?
It'll be a great festival. If the amount of detail and energy you put into organising me is anything like what you're doing with people, I'm sure it is. And I'm sure it'll be a wonderful festival. And I think we are, and I say this quite genuinely, we are incredibly lucky to have you as an advocate and a festival director in the Wairarapa, you know, doing this out of interest rather than self-interest. So I just want to thank you very much for that.
Well, you're very kind. And there is something I need to say before we sign off. I have a lovely friend, and his name is Matthew Ward, and he's one of my favourite people in the entire world. And he's living in Japan, but he was in the media film communication department down at Otago University. We were both postgrads at the time. My specialty was New Zealand documentary film. His specialty was science fiction, and particularly television. And he will listen to this podcast, Vincent, because he listened to the first one that I did with you. And he said, oh, Vincent is just such a natural and gifted storyteller. I agree. But he was disappointed that I didn't ask you about Alien 3. And he's going to say the same thing. But I feel that's a whole other podcast in its own right. I think we dedicate another sitting down to talk about that, because that is something I really want to talk more to you about.
Okay.
Yeah? You're on for that?
Sure. There's some quite good articles about it online. And there's a book about it that has chapters in it about it, rather.
Wow.
So I can send you some links, you know.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Another, may I say, another misadventure. But, you know, the thing with my follies, of which there are many, you know, sometimes the follies turn into something wonderful. And so it's this sort of journey we have, and I've come to accept it, that unless you venture to do something, unless you're prepared to create a potential folly, unless you're prepared to take significant risk, you won't do anything original. So you have to do that. And generally, those misadventures turn into something really positive, because you have risked your shirt on them. Occasionally they don't. But Alien 3 has a sort of whole reputation on its own, the one I wrote, as opposed to the one that was made, which I, you know, but that is another story, Jane.
It is another story for next time. I want to thank you for the time that you've given me today, and I do mean this as well, and I want to really thank you for the stories that you tell and for the stories that you will continue to tell. I can't wait, And I'm really looking forward to having you here in the Wairarapa. And everyone should immediately, after listening to this podcast, go to the Regent Three Cinemas website where you can book your tickets online. And so that's regent3.co.nz. Tickets are available from tomorrow, the 1st of May. And let's encourage everyone to come along. And you have that really wonderful opportunity at the Wairarapa Film Festival where every screening will always have somebody to talk to the film. And over the years, it's either been the director or the actor or sometimes producers. I've had cinematographers. There's always an amazing array of creative people who are always so happy to talk about everything that goes into creating the stories that we so love. So see you soon, Vincent.
I think we'll have a great time, and I think the audiences, even more importantly, will have a wonderful time.
Yes.
Because I think it'll be a great experience.
Yeah. Can't wait. Na mihi nui, Vincent. Talk to you soon.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.